It's February 20th. You're listening to The Christian Commute with your host, Seth Dunn. You're joining me mid-commute because I had to stop for gas. I decided those shows where I started the program and then stopped for gas. They were just a little, I don't know, off-putting. They threw me off balance. So here I am already getting on the interstate. I have a great gas station that I go to. It's literally right next to the interstate. So I just pull in and pull out and I'm there. And I don't have to get any kind of strange traffic. And the gas prices are better there than they are in Cartersville where I live. Today, I have another full show for you. I've got a show topic. The show topic is Prestonwood Baptist. I don't know what I want to name it. Prestonwood Baptist Church has suspended its cooperative program giving. And for those of you listeners who are not Southern Baptists, you guys might like yawn. What do you care? But the other parts of the show may be interesting to you. I'm going to talk about really about ecclesiology. What Prestonwood's cooperative giving decision means about ecclesiology. Because I think we're losing sight of ecclesiology in Baptist life. And maybe this incident will help us gain it back. I've got a question in the inbox from Texas, so we'll get to that. It's from a woman, and it's about lady stuff. Like, what is a lady to do when she's polemicky and her husband is a kind of a quiet guy? So we'll get to that. But first, we're going to do today's Bible chapter review. Only two verses in today's Bible chapter review. We are beginning a review of 1 Corinthians 15. This is Paul's discourse on the resurrection. And the point he makes right out of the gate is that the resurrection and the gospel are inextricably linked. Now, the reason he's addressing the gospel is because there apparently are people in the number of the Corinthians, whether there be people who count themselves as part of the church or outside detractors, there are people who are denying the resurrection. Right? And I would like to deny this person in front of me in the Honda Civic from Haywood County, Tennessee. I would like to deny them the fast lane, but I can't because I'm not sovereign over them. So I'll just pass that little lady who, goodness, she's going away from Haywood, Tennessee. I don't know if she'll ever get back there at the rate she's going. All right, so there are people in the Corinthian church who are unsure of the resurrection, we'll say. So Paul is making, I don't know, I don't want to say he's making a defense for the resurrection as much as he's saying, hey, y'all, listen, there's no gospel if there's no resurrection. And here's what the resurrection is. So for the next few shows, that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking about the resurrection. So let's get started right away here with verses 1 and 2 of 1 Corinthians 15. Paul makes it clear that the resurrection is something he preached, something that the Corinthian church received, and it is something in which the Corinthian church now stands. You stand in the gospel, you stand in the resurrection. They have received the gospel which Paul preached, and the gospel is inextricably linked to the resurrection. You cannot have a gospel without a resurrection. So when Paul came preaching the gospel to the Corinthian church, they received the gospel, and by receiving the gospel, they received the resurrection. And Paul says, you know, unless you believed in vain, you know, if my preaching was in vain. Now this if here, if you hold fast to the resurrection, if you hold fast to the belief. Paul's not saying that they can lose their salvation. Because listen, if you don't believe in the resurrection, you don't have salvation. So Paul's not talking about people who received the gospel, became regenerate, and then lost their salvation by saying if. The word if here in 1 Corinthians 15 verse 2 is what's known as a first-class conditional. The Greek language has classes or orders of conditional statements. So here's one. If I make it home today, I'm going to eat tortilla soup for dinner. It's tortellini soup. My wife made tortellini soup. All right. I know that. So if I make it home today, I'm going to eat tortellini soup for dinner. I don't know if I'm going to make it home or not. I assume I'm going to make it home, unless, you know, I could crash. Aliens could abduct me, you know, whatever things that could... I don't believe in aliens, but, you know, whatever reason, there could be many reasons for me not making it home, but if I do get there, I know what's for dinner because my wife's already made it. But God knows if I'm going to make it home to have tortellini soup tonight. So let's say if God said, if Seth makes it home tonight, he's going to make tortellini soup. God would be making a true statement if I make it home, and God also knows if I'm going to make it home. So there's really no such thing as an if for God. There's an if for you, but not an if for God. In kind of a similar way, that's how these first order conditionals work, is you presume the case. Okay? So when you use a first order conditional in Greek, it's presuming the case. So if Paul were to say, if Seth makes it home, he's going to eat tortellini soup. If he's using a first order conditional, Paul is assuming that I'm going to make it home and eat tortellini soup. All right, so now I'm just made myself hungry. My wife made tortellini soup in the crock pot. So this is a first order conditional when Paul says, I preach the gospel, you receive the gospel, you stand in the gospel, and you are being saved by the gospel if you hold fast. Well, he's saying, yes, you are holding fast by that first order conditional. So the belief that they have in the gospel, those who believe, it's not in vain, because they are believing in Paul's statement. He's presuming the case by that first order conditional. Right, so what do we take from 1 Corinthians 15? Well, that the gospel and the resurrection are inextricably linked, and the church has received Paul's preaching of the gospel. It is in that gospel that they now stand, and that the believers are holding fast to it. All right, so we'll end our Bible chapter review right there, and Lord willing, we will pick up verse 3. Tomorrow. Now, I have a submission in the inbox. Do you have a question about apologetics, about theology, or do you have a show topic suggestion for the Christian Commute? The Christian Commute is your theological roadside assistance, and you can write SethDunn88@gmail.com, SethDunn88@gmail.com. And I will remind you that this is the first and best Christian podcast that someone does in his car. So don't be wasting your questions on Richard Haas's driving podcast. No, I'm just kidding. You can write Richard too. I don't remember the name of his email address. Just to update some of you listeners, Richard Haas, who is a buddy of mine, he's an admin with me at the Pulpit and Pen Facebook group. And he writes for Pulpit and Pen sometimes. He has a podcast called The Crossroads Radio Show. And I think my podcast feed is on his website. And his podcast feed is on the Pulpit and Pen website. Richard is a busy working family man like me. And he couldn't find time to podcast. So he said, I'm going to do it in my car. So now he has a podcast called Drive Time Apologetics. Drive Time Apologetics. And it's basically the same format as this show, in that he talks about apologetics and you can write in and have a question answered. I think his show is about 20 minutes long because his commute is shorter than mine. So mine's twice as long, but it's the same show. So it would be fun for some of you, write into me and then write into Richard, see if we give the same answer. Because two sound Protestant theologians should be giving the same answer, right? So SethDunn88@gmail.com, that's the Christian Commute inbox if you want to write in to me. I appreciate it when you do. I think I've had 3 shows in a row where people have written in. So this is, maybe it's four. But today, yeah, I think it's four. Today, Aaron from Texas writes in. And I was talking about spiritual dryness in the episode the other day, and how I didn't think there was any such thing. But I was also talking about women remaining silent in church. And I made the point, which I'm sure many of you recognize, that a lot of times there's men who are very quiet in Sunday school and their wives are talkative. And the Bible says that if a woman has a question in church, she needs to go home and ask her husband. So women are supposed to be quiet in church, and if they have a question, go home and ask her husband. Well, what if your husband's just not the theological type and he's just not one to say anything? So here you have a woman, and Aaron used the term polemiki. That's a J.D. Hall word. I think that's a J.D. Hall, where it's a J.D. Hall adverb and a J.D. Hall adjective. People who are geared towards polemics. And I guess Aaron is. And if she wasn't, she probably wouldn't be listening to this show. So good for you, Aaron. But you have a wife, and she's got comments. So let's say, you know, you're in church and people are talking about Beth Moore, and the church announces it's going to have a Beth Moore study, and somebody like Aaron wants to raise her voice and say, "No, Beth Moore is terrible. We shouldn't be studying Beth Moore or Priscilla Shower, or no, we shouldn't be going to the IF conference," or whatever. You know, but the woman's supposed to remain silent in church and, you know, go home and ask her husband. And her husband's not the type of guy who's going to sit there and say, "No, no Beth Moore, no Joyce Meyer. We're not going to have that." Just a quiet guy. What's that wife to do? Well, number one, thank God that you have a husband who balances you out. You know, maybe it was by God's providence if you're someone to kind of open up your mouth and give a strong opinion, that you have a husband who doesn't say much. Because maybe you can put your foot in your mouth. Sometimes I think, this is just my opinion, that God gives us spouses to kind of balance out our less than desirable qualities. And it works both ways. If you're too aggressive and you have a passive spouse, well, you might make your spouse more aggressive. They think, "My spouse is aggressive, I should be more aggressive." But then, if you're an aggressive spouse and you have a passive spouse, you're like, "You know what? Maybe I should be more passive." And then you end up in that good middle there. Sorry, that's just my opinion. I didn't pull that out of scripture. That's kind of like five love languages type stuff, you know? My opinion. And by the way, five love languages, that's what I'm saying. It's a Christian guy who's giving his opinion, but it's not necessarily scriptural. That's just me, same way. I'm just giving my opinion. Aaron, what I would do is, if I were you, I would go home and I would tell your husband, "I have an issue at church. And maybe you didn't see it, husband, but here's what it is, and I need you to speak up about this for me. Now that I've made you aware of it, I need you to go speak up about this." So practically, that's what you're supposed to do. If it's something like Beth Moore and your women's group is planning it, well, you're a woman and they're a woman, you can just go tell them. "No, I don't think this is a good idea, ladies. This is terrible. Let's not do it." But it could be a blessing for you if you have a quiet husband. Because seriously, Aaron, and this goes to all the women listening, do you want to be that woman? And you know who I'm talking about, who's got her husband henpecked, and you can tell she's the one who wears the pants in the family. When I was growing up, or not growing up, when I was in high school, I had a friend named Matt. And Matt was on the tennis team with me. And his mother's name was Carol, and his dad's name was Randy. And if you were to ask who's in charge at Matt's house, everybody would say Carol's in charge at Matt's house. Carol was a force to be reckoned with. And Carol Willis was good to me. I want to say this, the Willis family, they were good to me, took me to tennis lessons a lot, you know, took me out to lunch with their family a lot. I enjoyed being friends with Matt and knowing that family. I had a lot of good times with the Willises. But I'm talking Carol was in charge of that family. And we all know a woman like that. She makes the decisions at the house. The woman has the stronger personality. So if you're the type of woman who has a strong personality like that, maybe you have some difficulty letting your husband lead or letting the male lead. And quite frankly, there could be some times where he should be leading and he's not, and you want to speak up and you want to say something. Consider it sanctification to remain quiet and submissive and in your proper gender role when your husband's not speaking up like he should. And also, you know, consider yourself lucky. Maybe there's times where he's not speaking up for a reason. Now's not the right time. So, Aaron, you know, your husband doesn't ride into the show. I don't know if he listens. I know you do. So don't take that the wrong way. You know, women listening, don't take that the wrong way. But it's very good not to be that woman who is overbearing and quote-unquote in charge of her house. That aggressive woman who's not letting her man lead. But don't hesitate when you notice something. You know, use your discernment. My wife has done this before. We would be in church and we'd get out of church at a prior church, and she'd say, "I don't know about that. That doesn't sound right to me." And I'd say, "You're right. That's not right." "Well, you need to say something." I said, "Well, you know, we'll wait a while. We might say something. Now's not the. Here's where I think the pastor's coming from. Here's his methodology. Here's where he's doing this." You know? So my wife knew she could come and raise an objection to me or raise a concern with me, and she trusted that I would have good insight on it and that maybe I would say something. Now, I'm the kind of husband who's not quiet. I would say something. You guys follow me on social media. I say something all the time. But even me, you guys might not believe it. Sometimes I see something that might be a problem, and I say, "I'm not going to say anything about that right now." I'm making a note. Sometimes quiet husbands are just making a note because they don't want to seem like they're crying wolf, as it were. When you're a quiet person and you speak, people are like, "Whoa, the quiet person said something, so what he's saying must be really important." So work as best you can with your husband, Aaron, or any ladies who are quote-unquote polemicky and have a quiet husband. Bring it up to your husband and, you know, put the impetus on him to say, "You know, honey, I think you need to say something about this. I would really appreciate it if you did. I've noticed this." And then maybe he will. So, Aaron, I hope that's helpful. I mean, it's no secret that there are women in this world who are more theologically astute than their husbands. Maybe they've been Christians longer. And it's no secret that there are women who are more outspoken theologically than their husbands. But when you're at church, you know, follow the order there that is set up by the Lord. Now let's talk about the cooperative program, Prestonwood Baptist Church, and church autonomy. If you're a Southern Baptist, especially if you're a Southern Baptist pastor, you probably think the cooperative program is the bee's knees. Like, it is the greatest mechanism for funding missions ever. And it cuts out a lot of waste and allows little churches to get together and do big things. And maybe in 1927, I think it was invented in 1921 or 1927, I never can remember. I even wrote a book about it, I can't remember. Maybe it was the best thing. But it's not now, because it just creates a bunch of middlemen and bureaucracy. And here's the problem. Pretty much all Southern Baptists agree that the most important thing we do cooperatively together is support international missions, specifically the International Mission Board. And that's why the lion's share of our national cooperative giving goes to international missions. So here's how it would work in Georgia, for example. A church would dedicate, say, 5% of its budget to the cooperative program, to its denominational giving, And let's say let's do easy math. Let's say they have a $500,000 budget for revenue. So 5% of $500,000, I believe that's $25,000, right? That's 1/20, I think. Yeah. The old accountant got it right. So they're giving $25,000 a year to the CB. And how that works is they give that $25,000 to the state convention. The state convention takes $12,500, keeps that for local missions, and then sends $25,500 on to the national Southern Baptist Convention. And then the Southern Baptist Convention splits that up between the seminaries, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, and the North American Mission Board and the International Mission Board. And out of that $12,500, the International Mission Board gets $12,000, and the $500 gets split up to the rest of the things, because it's international missions that gets almost all of the money. All right. But that $500 from all those other churches, that starts to add up, and it gets really big. And what's it get into? It gets into about $4 million, and that's the budget of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is run by Russell Moore, who is a man that many a Southern Baptist has grown to detest, much to the dismay of pastors who have been indoctrinated to be champions of the cooperative program. They were indoctrinated at the Southern Baptist Seminary to give their churches money to the cooperative program. So they say the cooperative program is the greatest thing. Our church needs to give the cooperative program. We need to give more and more and more. And then individual pew sitters say, well, hold on a minute. I don't like what this cooperative program money is going to. It's just a little bit, but it's going to Russell Moore, and I don't like him. Let's not do that. So then the pastor is in a tough situation. He's like, oh, what am I going to do here? I've been pushing this. Well, here's what Jack Graham of Prestonwood Baptist Church did. Now, this is a big deal because Jack Graham is a former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, and his church is giant. His cooperative program giving budget is $1 million. Million with an M, okay? With six zeros. And Jack Graham took a look at what the ERLC and Russell Moore was doing and saying, and he says, I don't like this. This doesn't represent me, and it doesn't represent the members of my church. So his church voted to escrow their cooperative program money. They're not going to send it in. And what they've decided to do, as this is what I've seen him talking about on Twitter, and what they've decided to do is they're just going to give that money right to international missions. Here's the fact, y'all. You guys don't have to give to the cooperative program to be a Southern Baptist. I wrote an article about this the other day. To be a quote-unquote Southern Baptist church, by the way, people are not Southern Baptists. I want to make that clear. You must say, I'm a Southern Baptist. Yes, I am, but not really. People are not Southern Baptists. Churches are. People are not Southern Baptists. Churches are. Baptist churches are autonomous, like the Bible says we should be. And Baptist churches choose to support and participate and cooperate with the Southern Baptist Convention. But it's not like United Methodist. Okay, if you're a United Methodist and you're a member of Sam Jones United Methodist Church, you go to your local Sam Jones United Methodist Church, and United Methodist General Conference can tell your church what to do. The Southern Baptist Convention, as I said before, can't tell an individual church what to do. So, you move to a different United Methodist Church. Well, you're still a United Methodist. It doesn't matter what United Methodist Church you're a part of. You're a United Methodist person because you are in a United Methodist Church, and the United Methodist Church can't be anything but United Methodist. But it's not how it works in Baptist world. A Baptist church can choose to no longer be Southern Baptist. They say, you know what? We're not going to give any money this year, and we're not going to cooperate with any Southern Baptist entity through the cooperative program or any giving fund. Well, they stop being Southern Baptist, but they're still Baptist. But you stop being quote-unquote Southern Baptist because your church isn't Southern Baptist. You see how that works? But the culture in the Southern Baptist Convention has become that Baptist churches just have to give to the cooperative program. They must. They just must. They owe the money to the cooperative program. And I've heard more than one preacher say this. And more than one preacher, I've heard him say that the gifts to the cooperative program are like the church's tithe. That is a very, very incorrect thing to say. It's a very bad analogy. Yes, in a sense, a tithe is an apportioned percentage of dedicated giving to something. So in a sense, yes. The cooperative program is like a Southern, like a Baptist church's tithe to the convention, in that they plan for it and it's a proportion. But when you look at what a tithe is biblically, it's something that's owed. It's not like an optional tithe, right? It's an obligation, right? In the Old Testament, the Jews were obligated to tithe, all right? And even in the New Testament, where we practice grace giving, you are obligated to support your church as a member there. Now, no, I'm not going to throw out a percentage to you and say, well, it has to be 10, or it has to be 15, or it has to be 5. But most church covenants, I think, will say, we covenant to be Christians together at this church, and we covenant to support the church financially. All right? So you're obligated to give to your local church. That's your church, and the people there have authority over you. All right? Yes, we're all a part of the priesthood of all believers. Yes, we all have soul competency before God. But you're under the authority of the elders at your church. And if the congregation at your church, votes to spend money on red carpet and you want green too bad, the carpet's going to be red. But you're under that church authority. But the church is not under the authority of the Southern Baptist Convention. The church doesn't owe the Southern Baptist Convention any kind of support via the cooperative program or otherwise. And big churches, quite frankly, don't need the Southern Baptist Convention. Take a big church like Prestonwood, like Jack Graham's church. Or, even take a big church like Ronnie Floyd's church, Cross Church in Arkansas, First Baptist Church of Woodstock, another big one around here, Church at Brook Hills, David Platt's former church, David Jeremiah's church, Shadow Mountain Community Church in California, that's a Southern Baptist church, Rick Warren's church, Saddleback Church, Perry Noble's church is nominally Southern Baptist, Stephen Furtick's church is nominally Southern Baptist. Now, all of these churches I mentioned, I'm not saying they're sound, I'm just saying they're big and they're technically Southern Baptist. They have multi-million dollar budgets. They don't need to, scrape their money together with somebody else to put a foreign missionary on the field. Like, the church where I grew up in Chattanooga, Woodland Park Baptist Church, is pretty big. It's not a mega church, I wouldn't say it by any means, but that church gives $100 a month to the cooperative program, and their missions budget is something like $400,000. They support their own missionaries. Big churches, and especially mega churches, can put their own missionaries on the field. The reason Southern Baptist churches began to get together to put missionaries on the field is to do kind of an economies of scale thing. But your average church size of a Southern Baptist church is 70 members. So if you have all these little 70-member churches, they don't have a $400,000 missions budget. Their budget might not be anywhere near $400,000. But if they all set aside $5,000 and pull it together, and there's thousands of these churches, well, they can make an international mission board and they can put missionaries on the field. That's great. So they need that program to do what they want to do with international missions. But a big megachurch doesn't need that. And if a big megachurch is giving $1 million to the convention and there's something they don't like going on in the convention, they can simply, we're not going to give to this. No. And Prestonwood has decided to still give, it looks like, to Southern Baptist International Missions. That's another thing about the cooperative program. When you give to the cooperative program, it's like you send a $1,000 check or a $10,000 check to the state mission board, and you let a bunch of bureaucrats decide what to do with your money. Well, we're going to give $5,000 to international missions, $2,000 to domestic missions, and $3,000 to lobbying and education. Well, you could have wrote that check yourself, right? But what's become dangerous here is this idea that's been permeated, and I'm going to repeat this again. This is the dangerous thing to Baptist ecclesiology, is that the Baptist churches owe the convention money. And even if the convention is doing something bad or objectionable, like employing Russell Moore, having the ERLC is bad enough, and it's $4 million that could be used for missions. But employing Russell Moore in it is just an affront to most Southern Baptist pew sitters. And some are starting to get sick of it. And now they're getting sick of it, and they don't want to give to the cooperative program anymore. And now it makes these kind of cooperative program champion guys look kind of bad. Because, like, well, they don't give the cooperative program. Why should we? Here's what needs to be preached all along in Baptist churches, is that our church is autonomous. We are not beholden to any convention or any denomination. And what makes us Southern Baptist, definitionally, is that we give to Southern Baptist causes, whether through the cooperative program or anything else. But here's the thing. It's voluntary giving. It's not obligatory giving. It is not a tithe. And the only reason a church should give to any missions agency, whether it be the Southern Baptist Convention, or whether it be something like Acts 29, or whether it be something like Campus Crusade, you know, you can name all these parachurch organizations or denominational organizations. The only reason a church should give to one of these organizations is that they agree with their mission doctrinally, and they think they're effective in carrying it out. So if you don't agree with the Southern Baptist Convention policies and statement of faith, don't give to it. But I mean, I do. I agree with their statement of faith and their mission, so I want to give to those things, but not all of them, because I disagree with some of it. But Baptist churches don't have to kick up money to the denomination. They don't owe that money. All right? They should be able to, and they are able to pick and choose what they want. But there's this pressure from up top in the convention, like, oh, you gotta give more money to the convention. No, I don't. So I would suggest here at your local church, maybe recommend to your finance committee, follow Preston Wood's lead. Now, a lot of people are saying this is really bad, and here's why. Because I want to give the other side of it. Because Preston Wood has $1 million, and they're mega. And if they withhold $1 million from the convention, by the way, $1 million, I want to put that in perspective, is 25% of the ERLC's budget. If four churches the size of Preston Wood did that, it's like there's no money for the ERLC. And the convention has to sit back and look and say, they're withholding money. They're saying why they're withholding money. They don't agree with Russell Moore. So if we get rid of Russell Moore, we'll get our $1 million back. The trustees of the ERLC say that. So people don't like that because it looks like the people with the most money are controlling what the convention does. Because what's the other way to get rid of Russell Moore? The other way to get rid of Russell Moore is to elect an SBC president. How about me? To elect an SBC president who would appoint nominating committees, who would then nominate trustees that would want to fire Russell Moore. And then you have anti-Moore trustees. And then do that for 10 years to where you finally packed the entire trustee board with anti-Russell Moore people, and they fire it. All right? That's a long, very democratic process. Or the rich church can just say, I'm not going to give $1 million. You can keep Russell Moore, you can have my $1 million. You have at it, trustees. And a lot of people don't like that. They say they're trying to control the convention with their money. And to that I say, it's their money. They don't owe that money to the convention. See, a lot of small church pastors have sat there for years because they were indoctrinated in seminary this way, saying, well, the cooperative program is the church's tithe. The cooperative program is the church's tithe. And then they'll say, hey, let's do this simulcast from Prestonwood. Or they'll quote Jack Graham, or they'll go to convention and vote for Jack Graham for president. So they look at the luminaries and the celebrity preachers like Jack Graham and say, Jack Graham's great. Preston Wood's great. Let me share his op-eds. Let me share his blogs. And then here comes the blog or the op-ed. Here comes the article in the Wall Street Journal, the article in the Dallas Morning News. This happened, and it says, Jack Graham, Preston Wood Baptist Church, suspends CP giving. So here's the preacher and the pastor of the small church, and he said, Preston Wood's great. On one hand, he's also said, the cooperative program is our tithe. Well, this big church over here is not paying their tithe. What are you going to do? Or are you going to polemicize them and say they're terrible and they're trying to use their money to control our convention? Are you going to say, oh, you know what? I think the ERLC is terrible too. You know what? This demonstrates that the cooperative program is not a sound program. We should stop giving to it too, and we should individually direct our money. And you know what? Prestonwood Baptist doesn't owe any amount of money to the Southern Baptist Convention. And that's the position I take. Yeah, they're using their money to do what they want. Is it going to influence the convention? Yeah, it's $1 million. It will. And other churches are going to follow suit. But here's the thing. That's how markets work. We turn into little socialists and communists when we say, no, you can't designate your money. Now, by the way, designating your money at the local church level is different than designating your money at the denominational level. Why? Because the denomination is not a church. The denomination is not a church. So you can't make that analogy because it's not a church. Churches have authority over individual believers. That denominations don't. So let me put it this way. You owe loyalty to your local church. But your church doesn't owe loyalty to the Southern Baptist Convention, and therefore it doesn't owe them any money. So I'm really one to take these guys to task who are saying, oh, look at Prestonwood, they're trying to control the convention with their money. No, you think you're entitled to their money. You think because you're a fellow Southern Baptist church, you can elect messengers with all these other little churches and gather together at the convention and all together how to decide everybody's money, including Prestonwood's. And Prestonwood's saying, nope, this is our money. We'll spend it how we like. Whatever happened to freedom? So spend your money how you like. If I could, I would make all churches not do the cooperative program. And I would make everybody say Russell Moore has to be fired. But I can't do that. All right? That's my opinion. And everybody else has the competency and freedom to have their own and do what they will with their money. So just take it from this, and I might title the show this. Your church doesn't owe the Southern Baptist Convention any of its money or loyalty. But hey, I'm a Southern Baptist, and I'm totally happy being one. Even trying to be president of the Southern Baptist Convention, believe it or not. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute today. God bless you, everybody. I got the catechism back in this car, but I have to remember what spot I'm in, so I'll look that up later. God bless.